The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And those conflicts between nations create real problems. And I think that we're headed toward a world where states are going to play a role in that. They're going to play a role in internet fragmentation and conflicts of laws that burden tech platforms. And I think it's going to be really deeply problematic.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, senior editor at Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare podcast, January 23rd, 2023. Today, we're bringing you an episode of Arbiters of Truth, our occasional series on the information ecosystem. Tech policy reform occupies a strange place in Washington, D.C. Everyone seems to agree that the government should change how it regulates the technology industry on issues from content moderation to privacy. And yet, reform never actually seems to happen. But while the federal government continues to stall, state governments are taking action. More and more, state-level officials are proposing and implementing changes in technology policy on their own. Most prominently, Texas and Florida recently passed laws restricting how platforms can moderate content, laws that will likely be considered by the Supreme Court later this year. To understand this trend, I spoke with J. Scott Bobois-Brennan and Matt Perrault of the Center on Technology Policy at UNC Chapel Hill. In the past year, they've put together two reports on state-level tech regulation. We talked about what's driving this trend, why and how state-level policymaking differs and doesn't from policymaking at the federal level, and what opportunities and complications state-level tech policymaking could create. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 23rd, when states make tech policy. Scott and Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Most of the conversations that we tend to have, both on the podcast and just, you know, generally when talking about tech policymaking, tend to be on the federal level. But the report that we're talking about here focuses on state-level initiatives. What led you to focus on the states?
It's sort of a kind of long, wandering sort of story about how we ended up like working on state issues. But I think in the biggest sense, it's what you just said, that so much of tech policy is, you know, that so much of the conversation focuses on the national or the international level. But, you know, as I'm you know, we're going to talk about in a minute, like, so like a what's happening at the states is really important and increasingly so. And so I think we realized that this was something that we didn't know that much about initially, but that was really important and needed to be addressed more directly.
We released a report last April about what states could do to regulate online content moderation. And the genesis for that, I think, was just that there were lots of states that were starting to do that. And we were seeing laws passed, laws proposed, speeches at the state level about the state role in regulating online speech. And that inspired us, I think, to think, well, what could a roadmap look like for content moderation regulation at the state level? And then when we did that, I think we got a lot of questions from people kind of asking us to look more broadly, I guess, at what was going on at the state level. And I think we realized that we had a sense that there was lots of activity. We certainly knew of stuff that was going on in privacy and saw various different press stories about things that were happening in antitrust, but we realized we didn't really know like systematically what was happening at the state level. And then, as actually has been the case with a lot of the reports that Scott and I have authored, the genesis for this sort of came from us looking for information that we wanted to get in order to understand this landscape better. So we initially, I think, started this project from the point of view of, we're going to go out and find the report that's written out there about what's happening in state policy, technology policy at the state level? Because surely that exists. Surely there's an overview about what's happening in tech at the state level. And we didn't really find that. And we kept looking for it and looking for it. And even as we were doing this report, we kept asking ourselves, is it actually the case that this exists somewhere and we're just duplicating something that exists? And it might be that it does exist somewhere, but we haven't found it. We haven't found something that just kind of looks comprehensively at what's going on in platform regulation at the state level. And once we sort of saw that gap, we were eager to try to fill it.
So why do you think there is that gap, right? Why aren't people paying more attention to it? Is it just because, you know, there are 50 states, there's DC and a bunch of territories, it's hard to figure out what's going on in so many different places? Is it because we're overly focused on the federal government? What is it?
I don't know. I mean, that's a great question. And I think, but I can offer some thoughts on this, or some guesses. I think it's a couple things. One, most of the regulations that deal with technology and technology platforms, right, like are national in scope. Like in the big ones that have been sort of like the most influential are sort of like national in scope, right? Like Section 230 or like, you know, COPPA from 20 years ago. I mean, you know, platforms sort of operate across the country, and we're dealing right with, you know, business that happens across state lines. And so it makes sense that like the national government is going to deal with this. But I think there's like another story there, which is you're pointing to, which maybe is more interesting about, you know, we tend to just be less interested in news that's happening at the state level anyway, right? Like, there's been this kind of long-running bias about that we're just more focused on national news than at state news. Part of that, I think, is like the decline of state-level news outlets doing the sort of like good, you know, rigorous coverage that we need on these issues.
I think one thing that was striking for us looking at this issue while also reading national reporting on what was going on in tech policy in Congress and doing that at the same time, because on the state side, we were seeing, and we can discuss this in more detail, this like structure that pushes in favor of reform actually happening at the state level, that state governments are well structured to do reform. And then also this big incentive from states, this momentum that states have to do reform. And so we're seeing all this action and potential action at the state level. And there was very little coverage of that. And at the same time, we were seeing a structure that I think is consistent with stagnation in Congress, but tons of reporting about what might or might not happen in Congress. And, you know, that's the some of the antitrust proposals and some of the issues related to journalism platform relationships and privacy and children's issues. From probably July 1st through the end of the lame duck Congress, there were lots and lots of stories in the tech press and in national outlets about what might happen in Congress. And I think some of that is that when you're a reporter and your beat is covering DC politics and policy, you're going to report on DC politics and policy. And so that means a lot of stories about this bill was just proposed and maybe this bill will pass and maybe it won't. I don't think there's a very strong incentive to cover what might be happening in a legislature in North Carolina or Arkansas or larger states, Texas, Florida, New York, and California, even to some extent. There's just not the incentive to cover it in the same way that you would be covering political issues in DC, even though the prospects and reform in DC seem so attenuated and the prospects of reform at the state level seem, you know, much, much higher.
Yeah, I will say that conversations around, you know, the possibility for tech reform, for social media regulation, antitrust, privacy, remind me a little bit of the running joke journalists had during the Trump administration about how it was always infrastructure week. The administration was always going to do something about infrastructure, and it never actually happened. You know, it's always privacy week. It's always social media policy making week.
Yep. It's always antitrust reform week. We're almost there. It's
exactly.
Happen. Yeah. And actually, it reminds me of a dynamic that I have with my daughter around bedtime. She always prefers her mom to put her to bed. We try to split time equally. And whenever I ask her if it's my turn to put her to bed, she always says, tomorrow is daddy's turn. Tomorrow is always the better day.
So I want to ask, before we get into the specifics, about Matt, what you just described in terms of the structure that pushes in terms of reform happening at the state level. What is that structure and why, in your view, does it differ from what we're seeing at the federal level? And also, if you could spell out a little bit more, you know, what we see happening at the federal level, because I think listeners are probably familiar with the idea that Congress is gridlocked and rarely does things. But I think giving a little more context in the specific context of tech policymaking would be helpful.
So at the structural side, I mean, it's really two things. First, it's more common, right, for states to have unified political control of government. And so after the 2020 midterms, I think now 39 states have what people call trifectas, which is a single party controls the governor's office and both houses of the legislature, which means they can, right, just a single party can pass legislation through without having to work with the other party. And so, you know, that makes it just that much easier to pass pieces of legislation. You know, we estimated that over the past term, as around 80% of bills, platform regulation bills, were passed under one of these trifectas. And so I think that's the biggest thing, right? And the same reason that we're now not expecting to see much happen at the national level, because we have a divided government, we're expecting, right now, 39 states have a single party control, at least of the legislation process. Yeah, I think the other thing is that few states have filibusters, and so some do, but actually the majority don't, and so it again just like lowers that threshold to what states have to do to actually get a piece of legislation passed.
Yeah, and that contrasts obviously with the federal level, where the filibuster is alive and well, and I think stands in the way probably of lots of reform where you could potentially get 51 votes in favor of it. I do think it's actually like a little bit of a mystery of why quote unquote sensible tech reform can't get through in Washington. Certainly policymakers want to lay that at the feet of tech companies. They make the claim all the time that tech company lobbying defeated a particular bill. And maybe that's the case, but it seems somewhat unlikely to me. There are tech lobbyists who are in Brussels. There are tech lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and the Digital Markets Act and Digital Services Act passed in Brussels over big tech lobbying efforts, whereas there's lots of legislation in Washington that can't move forward. And so I think it's probably more likely a structural issue as opposed to, or something related to the how Americans tend to feel about the underlying policy initiatives, as opposed to the fact that the idea that there's a lobbyist who can actually stop a bill from happening. And I'm not quite sure exactly how that is different from what happens at the state level. There is no filibuster, but obviously, you know, I think it's difficult to figure out still, I think, what the right tech policy reform agenda is. That's no different at the state level or at the federal level or at the international level. So it is interesting to see that on the international side and on the state side, they've been able to find ways for momentum in a way that the federal government hasn't.
So let's talk about what the landscape looks like in terms of the policy proposals that have been offered at the state level. You sketch out a number in your report. Obviously, it's been a few months since then, and new legislatures have come into office. They've put proposals on the table. What kinds of things have states proposed and actually implemented?
Yeah, so, well, the report looks at five areas of platform regulation: privacy, content moderation, antitrust, child safety, and then taxation. And so, you know, it's said, right, like, you know, we see different sorts of proposals in each of those categories. You know, I'll start with privacy, because I think, you know, it's probably the, you know, one of the most significant here, and certainly we're seeing the most action now already in this year. So, you know, over the past, was it five years since 2018, five states have passed comprehensive privacy, consumer privacy legislation: California, Utah, Colorado, Virginia, and Connecticut. And in the previous session, like, you know, I think two passed. bills, but many others, you know, more than a dozen, introduced and were considering these sort of comprehensive consumer privacy bills, were already seeing those sorts of bills being introduced in states. I think I saw someone estimated it something like, you know, almost 10, nearly 10 sort of comprehensive data privacy bills have already been introduced just in the past, you know, already in this month. And you know, on one side, it really speaks to, you know, that we're not unlikely to see a sort of like national, you know, level consumer privacy bill pass anytime soon. But there seems to be like a lot of momentum and maybe even sort of like growing momentum here. I think what's really kind of notable here is that, you know, these bills, you know, offer consumers, you know, a range of different new rights as it relates to you know, to their data, whether that's editing the data that companies hold about them or viewing it or downloading it or opting out of their data being used. But so of the five that have been passed, four of them, which are all based more or less on this model from Washington, the Washington Privacy Act, do not include a private right of action for individuals to file lawsuits against companies for violations, unlike the California bill, which does. I think we are seeing a lot of bills now in other states that adopt that same model, the Washington Privacy Act, that do not sort of have that private right of action. I think the other sort of key thing about these is having that opt out rather than an opt in provision. There's been sort of a lot of analysis that you know that it really makes a big difference, right? Like, what's the default, right? Is the default that companies are not allowed to make use of user data unless that they're given explicit permission, or is the default that they can unless the consumers opt out? And we're seeing sort of that opt out standard being the one that's kind of more common. I think the other thing to say about privacy is beside these like huge sort of comprehensive bills, seem to be a lot of interest in sort of like more narrowly targeted bills dealing with online privacy. So kind of most notably, whether it's like biometric data privacy or genetic data, we're seeing a number of bills that passed in the previous session and that are already been introduced.
Quinta, I don't know if we can ask a question back in your direction, but I'm kind of curious, you follow this stuff closely. How close would you have gotten to the number five for the number of privacy bills passed since 2018? Because I was expecting when we started this report, I think just based on kind of my sense through osmosis of kind of like tech policy news and stuff, I think I would have said the number was much higher. Is five in line with what you would have expected?
I think that's probably around what I would have guessed. But I will say I've seen a lot more reporting on the California Privacy Rights Act than anything else. That it feels like California has kind of saturated the news for whatever reason. But I think that does go to your sort of underlying point that it's actually really difficult to keep tabs on what is happening in all of these different states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think we were surprised across pretty much all the issues that we tracked, maybe not content moderation, maybe we had like a little bit of a better sense of that. But for the other issues, I think I was surprised, at least I won't speak for Scott, but I was surprised that the number of bills that have actually been passed is relatively few. And so it's like five in privacy and antitrust. There's been no sweeping reform of antitrust law at the state level. New York proposed a bill that would have done that, but it didn't pass. There was also lots of attention to various different app store regulatory proposals in states like Arizona. I don't believe any of those passed either. So even though there was like a lot of smoke around antitrust reform, there wasn't actually anything meaningful passed. So with this report, we sort of did two things. We were kind of looking retrospectively at what happened over the last term. And then we were also trying to predict going forward what might be likely to happen. And so the number five in privacy is kind of a summary of where we've stood over the last couple years. And then the question for us is whether you'd see that rate of past legislation increase in the years ahead. And I think our expectation is that it would, that there are now several different models, not just the California model, as Scott described. There's also this Washington model for what privacy legislation might look like. That gives states different options to choose from in thinking through privacy legislation. And there hasn't been privacy legislation at the federal level. So that gives states some momentum and motivation to move forward and think about legislation in this area. They don't, as Scott was saying earlier, have the filibuster in place and other structural impediments. So I think we would see that rate, we would likely see that rate increase. But I think it is kind of notable that even though there has been activity, and that's different than what's happened at the federal level, it's actually like a relatively slow rate so far.
And what have we seen in the way of content moderation? I think at this point, listeners are probably familiar with a sort of big ticket Texas and Florida legislation, which has been appealed. It's been dealt with in the appellate courts. It is probably going to be taken up by the Supreme Court. These are laws that variously impose some transparency requirements and sort of limit the ability of platforms to moderate content. Tell me about other initiatives on the state level.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there were two others that kind of big ones that were passed recently. One is a transparency bill in California that imposed some requirements about, I think, quarterly or semi-annually, like transparency reports that platforms have to file, and some rules around like disclosing their community standards. And then this New York bill, which was passed in the wake of the Buffalo shooting, that I think also has some transparency provisions, but then also has some imposes some requirements about reporting hate speech. So I think those are the only other two big ones that passed. I think the thing about the Florida and the Texas bills is, you know, those are the only two sort of like, you know, the like that passed, but there were, you know, dozens and dozens of other bills that had been introduced across states that did very similar sort of things. As far as I can tell, right, a lot of those bills were just sort of like messaging bills. In fact, there were like 15 all with essentially identical language. I think it was called like the Stop Social Media Censorship Act that, you know, short on detail, but, you know, took this really hard line sort of in prohibiting, you know, I think it was like deleting or censoring users' religious or political speech just across the board.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes
15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So that gets to something that I was curious about, which is how much variation you're seeing in these laws across states and across parties. Because of course, you know, when we talk about state-level policymaking, people often think of this idea of the laboratories of democracy, that the states are able to kind of experiment, play with different things. Maybe, you know, something that works in Washington is not something that's going to work in California or New York, and you can pick a similar spread of red states. On the other hand, as you said, you know, a lot of these, when we hear about, you know, state legislatures introducing bills, a lot of the time, in part because American politics has become so nationalized, there's actually a striking degree of similarity across states, particularly when it comes to, you know, sort of high profile political issues like tech policy has now kind of become. Are you seeing things more, you know, are you seeing variation across states and between states governed by the same party? Or is it really more sort of the familiar red and blue lines that we see in the US Congress?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess a couple things. So first, you're right that there tends to be kind of maybe more similarity across states in a lot of these areas than you might expect. And I think you're absolutely right that like part of this is these like big national issues, like a lot of states kind of just follow on. I think the other sort of side of that is to just recognize what it's like to do, you know, lawmaking or policymaking at the state level, right? Like state legislatures are filled with lawmakers who are, for the most part, part-time, who may not have the ability to employ large staffs to help write bills or review policy. And the lawmakers themselves might not have a great deal of expertise in the topics that they're discussing and they're considering. And so, you know, in that landscape, other organizations have a lot of sort of influence, whether that's writing model bills or draft legislation, or just kind of providing, you know, expertise and advice kind of behind the scenes. And so I think you know, or, you know, a lawmaker in one state sees something happening in another state and just sort of, I mean, for lack of a better word, just kind of copies the legislation that's being introduced. And so I think that sort of, you know, explains some of the commonality seen. You know, the question of like the difference between the left and the right here, I think is a much sort of bigger topic. And I think in dealing with tech, I think what's kind of fascinating to me is that the party lines, the divisions don't always sort of fall as you might expect. And we actually see maybe more agreement than you might expect, at least at the level of like recognizing that there's a problem, or like at the level of, you know, interest or commitment to doing something in the realm of platform regulation. Now that does sort of fall apart when it gets to the specifics, you know, of like what exactly needs to happen. But you know, we see both the left and the right, like kind of agreeing that there should be additional transparency requirements placed on platforms, or agreeing that we need additional privacy protections for consumers. You know, that doesn't always work out in terms of like grand compromise.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very familiar at the federal level too, right? That there's a sort of a general sense that the internet is bad now, but nobody can agree what to do about it. I mean, you note in the report that sort of there are Democrats who want platforms to take more things down. There are Republicans who want platforms to leave more things up. And so even though there's a sort of generalized dissatisfaction, there's actually no real agreement on what precisely the problem is. And I wonder whether that goes back to the point that you made earlier on, that because there are more and more state legislatures that are unified in control with the governor, that just makes it easier for one party to kind of bulldoze ahead in a way that's not really possible at the federal level. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like certainly as it relates to like content moderation, yeah, like both parties agree that, you know, something's wrong and maybe there is a space for the government to sort of do something here, but they have total diametrically opposed sort of accounts of like what the problem is. But you're totally right too, that the successes we see at the state are pretty much, yeah, a result not of like compromise across the parties, but of a single party being able to get legislation through.
I do wonder if a culture of experimentation is part of what drives state activity, that the laboratories of democracy line is not just kind of a abstraction, but is actually something that states take seriously, and they're more willing to experiment with different policy options than federal lawmakers might be. I still think it's a really interesting thing to try to put your finger on what were the contributing causes to a Congress where House and Senate are both controlled by Democrats and a White House controlled by a Democrat, where Democrats have run on reforming the tech sector as one component of their policy agenda. And they have that unified government for two full years and aren't able to get through meaningful reform of the tech sector. Again, I think there's like tends to be a sort of knee-jerk reaction to point a finger at tech lobbying. And that just, I think that probably is a factor. I don't think it's the driving factor. And I do wonder a little bit if there's not a structure in Washington to pass proposals sort of for the purpose of experimentation, to try to understand how they actually work in practice, and then to learn from that, and then to improve those policies over time. And it seems like at the state level, there's a little bit more willingness to move in that direction. I think in tech generally, there's just an enormous amount that we don't know. Like I think, for instance, that there are a lot of elements of comprehensive privacy legislation that will make it more difficult for startups to compete with large platforms. I don't know that that's the case. I'm guessing that that's the case. I think there are reasons that I think my judgment there is informed, but it's also very possible that that judgment will be wrong. And so I think it's constructive that states would do things that I might or might not agree with, you might or might not agree with, Scott might or might not agree with, but where we can see from policy that's implemented how it affects various different considerations over time, and then learn something about what smart tech policy looks like going forward. And that's just not really happening in Washington. That activity is really international and at the state level.
Yeah, that gets to something that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, to some extent, it seems like a lot of the tech policy proposals in Congress, some of which seem to really have legs, have fallen down because they just weren't very good, right? And that's not to say that Congress never passes bad laws. Of course it does. And I think that the recent reform to Section 230, which goes by the acronym FOSTA, that carves out holes in Section 230 for content related to sex trafficking, is a great example of a terrible policy that was successfully made by Congress. But, you know, you see all kinds of things with the antitrust legislation, for example, that seemed like it might really go somewhere, that there was an outcry from a lot of journalistic and tech policy think tanks. There was the Earn It Act that would have addressed encryption policy that also there was a lot of criticism of, and it also went nowhere. So I wonder, though, you know, when you look at the policies that are being proposed and actually passed and implemented on the state level, are they good policies in your view? Like, even if you don't agree with them, are they interesting, thoughtful, creative ways to address these problems? Or is it more that, you know, these are state governments that are able to kind of push ahead when the federal government might get snarled up? And so we end up with potentially bad policy that is being implemented and kind of experimented with, but might not be something that you'd actually want in a perfect world to see implemented.
So I think it's a great question. And we actually tried to stay away from kind of a prescriptive approach in the report. We tried to stay away from kind of coding various different proposals as good or bad. But I think the short answer, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but I think the short answer to your question is actually, if we're honest with ourselves, we don't know. My guess is that CCPA, which is the privacy regulation in California, will decrease innovation and will make it harder for startups to compete with large incumbent platforms. But I might be wrong about that. My hope would be that we really try to learn from the implementation of these laws to understand if they work in practice. And I think probably my deepest concern is that we don't have a mechanism for doing that. And I think FOSTA, the example that you raised, is a really good one. There was all this debate beforehand about whether FOSTA was going to be productive in practice. It was supposed to protect sex workers. Now there's a movement amongst sex workers that are campaigning for the law's repeal. And we don't have a mechanism, I don't think, in place for looking really closely at the effect of a law after it's passed and then figuring out whether it should be continued or repealed based on how it's actually performed in practice. And I think that absence of that experimental approach leads to bad laws. You and I agree, FOSTA's not a good law. Being on the books indefinitely, I think it's going to be very difficult for FOSTA to ever be repealed. It politically would be incredibly challenging for someone to repeal it. So I think it's going to be on the books indefinitely. So that approach enables bad laws to perpetuate. It also means there's a lot of uncertainty about what actually makes for good law. So if it's the case that I'm wrong about some of my assumptions about CCPA, and that's the right model for states to use to think about privacy regulation, then it would be really helpful to have that data so that more states can adopt that model as opposed to choosing other models that might be less constructive.
And so is there a way to collect that data? Obviously, you know, it's a little hard. You can think of this as running experiments in 50 states, but of course there are so many variables that you can't actually isolate. You can't have a version of Washington state that adopts one law and a version that adopts a different law. How would you go about collecting that information?
So I've tried to think a lot about this and embarrassingly, I don't think I have very good answers to it. So one thing I think that you can do is put in place in legislation really strong frameworks for auditing and understanding the impact of the bills and to embed that in the legislation. So you create audit committees or oversight boards or multi-stakeholder bodies, you know, made up of academics and industry and other types of experts who could develop reports or make recommendations based on the performance of something in practice. Obviously, there are issues around making it possible and facilitating, incentivizing platforms to share data that researchers can use to evaluate whether something has performed well in practice. I think there are a range of other issues too. I mean, Scott and I have talked extensively and written about a little bit incentives in the within academia to actually do research on these kinds of issues. I think often these kinds of issues are not particularly compelling for academics to study. And we need there to be, I think, more funding around kind of brass tacks evaluation of how various different laws perform in practice in order to generate the kind of insights that will enable us to make to reach better conclusions, smarter conclusions about what policy works and what doesn't. And there are places all over the world now where I think this gap in learning is really significant. Like Europe is in the midst of the biggest overhaul of tech regulation of our time. I think the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act are really going to, in fundamental, important, generational ways, shape the future of the tech sector. And I don't believe that will just be in Europe. I think it will be globally. But what are the mechanisms that we have in place to understand the trade-offs inherent in the rules? I don't think that you get anything cost-free, and the Digital Markets Act will have costs. How are we quantifying those costs? And what are the mechanisms that we're putting in place so that we can learn about them? And are we developing similar mechanisms on the benefit side to understand, do the promises of an act like that that is so significant, are we seeing the benefits that align with what the promised we have been promised from policymakers who pass those laws? So I just don't think we have kind of a culture or structure of learning and experimentation and data collection that really enables us to understand what smart tech policy looks like.
So I want to talk a little bit about what it looks like to have all of these different policies kind of layered on top of one another. And I think that, you know, talking about international regulation coming from Europe is a useful way to do that, because there's certainly been a lot of conversation among tech policymakers in the United States about how, you know, the DSA and the Digital Markets Act, they're coming, they're here, they're going to shape how companies act, because in the same way that Americans started getting a lot of emails about how companies were very concerned about protecting their data when the General Data Protection Regulation came out a few years ago in Europe, it doesn't really make sense for companies to have, you know, one system for privacy, content moderation, et cetera, on one side of one border and another one on the other side. If we envision, you know, state tech policy making, what we then end up with is this kind of, you know, layer cake where you have the state policy, the U.S. federal policy, which may or may not exist, but there are, of course, federal laws that constrain what states can do, and then international policy coming from Europe on top. So I'm interested for your thoughts on how that works. Would you expect that that would create chaos? Are we going to end up in a situation where platforms kind of cater to the lowest common denominator, or I guess the highest common denominator in terms of abiding by the strictest regulations? What would you expect to see?
I think this is exactly the right question, and in some ways seems like the kind of the most important issue, I think, for tech platforms and probably users of tech products over the next few years. And that's because it won't just be, I don't think, least common denominator issues. I think we should also anticipate that there are going to be direct conflicts between states around what the legal regime looks like. And the lens that we've used to look at that is how states will react to a world where Roe versus Wade has been overturned. And they'll take action, I think, in privacy and content moderation related to abortion that will put states in direct conflict with each other. And this isn't just speculative. This is already happening. California passed a law prohibiting platforms from providing user data in response to requests from other states in abortion-related investigations. So if Texas wants to prosecute someone for receiving an abortion out of state, for instance, if they are trying to get user data from a tech platform that is operational in California, that tech platform will be obligated under Texas law to provide data in response to the Texas Attorney General's request, and will be prohibited by California from providing that exact same data. And that puts platforms in an impossible position. And I think it's very unclear what that will mean in practice. We know what that looks like a little bit from international conflicts we've had, where the Indian government or the Brazilian government is requiring a tech platform to provide data in a case where the platform believes it's barred under US law from providing that data. And what that the result of that is that executives get arrested, or services are blocked or banned, or there are massive fines that are issued, or there are different compromises that are made that I think raise concerning human rights issues. And those conflicts between nations create real problems. And I think that we're headed toward a world where states are going to play a role in that. They're going to play a role in internet fragmentation and conflicts of laws that burden tech platforms. And I think it's going to be really deeply problematic.
I agree with most of what Matt said. I mean, I think the other side of that, though, is to go back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. not that much has happened, right? Like, states haven't actually passed that many significant bills in regards to platform regulation. So we have a handful of privacy laws, which are actually pretty similar. You know, I'm sure that companies would, many companies would complain that already they have many headaches about how to comply with, you know, all of these different existing rules. But yeah, I mean, certainly the situation Matt is describing is really concerning. And I think, especially in that specific instance, I think going to lead to some really, really or scary and difficult situations. But, you know, as it relates to some of these other areas, I think we just have to sort of see how it all kind of plays out.
We've talked to other people in the industry, by which I mean not just companies, but like people who work at various different advocacy organizations and stuff. And I don't know if anyone is as exercised about this issue as we are. I mean, it seems so inevitable to me that abortion will drive laws that create real challenges for platforms, and that those don't end up just being like abstractions, but actually create risks and burdens and problems for users. But as Scott is alluding to, like it could be that we're wrong about that. It could really be that the volume is not as acute as we think it is. And, you know, going back to our conversation about experimentation and learning and stuff, I mean, it would be very interesting to understand if there ends up being a very limited volume of abortion related legislation that implicates the tech sector. That will be really interesting to understand why that's the case. I can't see it. It just seems like states that lean left have a very strong incentive to do things that are protective of reproductive rights. States that lean right have a very strong incentive to take more restrictive approaches to reproductive rights, and they will move very hard in those directions. And because abortion, I think, involves how you can speak and what you can say, and also your right to control your data, I think tech companies will be implicated, but we might be wrong.
So are there things that you would like to see from states? Do you have particular recommendations that you have in mind?
Yeah. So in the report that we put out at the beginning of the year that looked just at, you know, state regulation of content, online platform content, we do have a series of recommendations. You know, the idea of that report really was like, you know, given that states seem to be interested in doing things like, you know, Texas and Florida, which, you know, in full disclosure, when we wrote the report, seemed maybe a bit more unlikely to actually endure than they do today. But the idea was, you know, there are all these kind of proposals which seem kind of terrible. What can states do that is clearly legal and might actually kind of improve the situation of online content? And what we ended up talking about is, you know, strengthening enforcement of existing sort of laws related to online expression. Things like bringing, you know, states have the capacity to sort of bring cases under existing UDAP, like unfair and deceptive trade practice laws for, I think we use the language like egregious and systematic violations. So when a company promises one thing and then doesn't do it, but in a big way, you know, they can bring cases. But on the other side, like, you know, states can really do a lot to help us just sort of better understand the problem, the problems that, you know, of online expression and online content. And so they can direct funds to research and study, and then they can do more to sort of just like build the underlying infrastructures that support sort of healthy communication, healthy dialogue. So they can support schools and universities and libraries. That's all, you know, really incredibly important work that states can do that simply we cannot have sort of like healthy online discussion without, but is often sort of overlooked in these conversations.
I think people often think of that sort of the idea of study to be a sort of throwaway is code for do nothing or protect large platforms or something like that. And I think that's a fair criticism. I understand why, you know, putting a lot of emphasis on trying to understand the problem more deeply doesn't feel satisfying to people, particularly if they're really focused on accountability. But Quinta, as we were saying earlier, just in like thinking about, you know, about FOSTA, why did that happen? What have we learned about it? How can that inform future policy? It does feel to me like there's a lot left to understand about the nature of both the challenges in this field, and then also about how different policies would play out in practice. Like what, you know, what are the real impact of various impacts of different policy proposals? And so we really mean, when we say put more emphasis on understanding, we really mean it as in an active way, like really trying to develop very concrete data gathering techniques, research, policy experimentation that would enable us to really have a much better understanding of what policies will work in practice. And so the idea here isn't to like stave off regulation. It's actually to try to create an environment where there would be smarter regulation in the future.
All right, let's leave it there. Scott and Matt, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks so much for having us.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, a Lawfare podcast series on the information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed or in the separate Arbiters of Truth podcast feed. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. This podcast was edited by Jen Pache Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.